This is the weekend edition of the Daily Gold Podcast, covering precious metals and global capital markets for intelligent investors. Now, here is your host, Jordan Roy Byrne.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Daily Gold Podcast. Thank you for joining me today. On this edition of the Daily Gold Podcast, we have one of our favorite guests on, returning guest, Greg Weldon, CEO of Weldon Financial. You can find his work at weldononline.com. Greg, it's great to have you back. How are you today?
Great, Jordan. My pleasure.
Greg, there's so much to talk about. The last time we had you on, I literally think it was days before this tremendous bull market began in precious metals, and you were one of the very few who was calling for it to happen. Of course, many people in the gold community were bullish, but they weren't saying it was going to happen this year or very soon, and you were on top of it right as it happened. I want to make that clear for our audience. I really commend you on that. And as we get started, I guess my first question with respect to precious metals, and I'll lump in bonds because they've kind of been moving together a little bit. Do you see anything that could or might or potentially could derail these strong moves in bonds and precious metals in the second half of the year? Is there anything that holders of precious metals and bonds would have to fear going forward?
Well, yeah, I think you fear a policy error. And I think the one of the reasons you see in the markets doing what they're doing right now is that the fear of a policy error has receded. So, that fear is always kind of omnipresent because you can never trust central bankers to do what you think they're going to do. If you've done this as long as you and I have, I'm 30 years in, you don't trust anyone. But from that perspective, I really believe that this is a process that began fourth quarter, late third quarter, really accelerated into late October, early November of last year, even relative to the Fed's dot plot, relative to the basic puppeteering that the Fed had done to get people to believe they were going to hike rates. They basically hiked rates without doing anything. And when you look at where the forward Eurodollar deposit rates, the forward Fed funds futures, were, they were where the dot plot was originally, looking for 375 on Fed funds by the end of next year. Okay, so look at where you are now. We said at the time that the Fed was going to engineer a doving down of the dot plot, bringing the dot plot to a more dovish level, not necessarily dovish per se, but certainly less hawkish, but, dovish dot plot, that just kind of works. So we went with that theme, and that has been a big theme in terms of, keeping the dollar from rallying. Because the last thing the Fed wanted to do was hike rates and meet their dot plot expectations in an environment where it would drive the dollar higher and squelch any chance they had to meet their inflation goal, and would keep, commodities down and continue to put pressure on emerging markets. They just couldn't do it. And they did exactly what we thought they would do, which was gradually dove down the dot plot. So basically, easing against a tightening that was, neither one of which ever actually happened. So, brilliant puppeteering, master of puppets is one of our general themes that we promote all the time in terms of central banks and especially the Fed. But the bigger picture issue is, we're here now. Okay, so the removal of a thought process around Fed rate hikes has pretty much been completed, especially with Brexit. So we're here now. What next? Is the ECB going to, they're already talking about deepening their, eligibility for QE, and this is bullish for Spain and Italy and so on and so forth, trying to maintain, the EU, trying to make sure that countries see that it would be punitive to leave, okay, number one. And then number two, the problem is, is the ECB, is that going to be effective beyond what they've already done? They're still not stimulating lending, really. I mean, lending grew and now it's flattened and, even contracting a little bit. The Japanese, same story. I mean, is another 10, 20 trillion yen going to make that big a difference, relatively speaking, in terms of, stimulating global growth? Well, the UK can cut rates. They will. Chinese, we said at the beginning of last year, the Chinese renminbi would come into play, and it did, October of last year, August to October. Took a little while, but that's played out, and that will continue to play out, especially because no one's paying attention to it anymore. The 12-month forward's not out of whack with where the spot is, so it's not being speculatively driven, and people have come around to accept it without, fleeing for the hills in terms of capital flow. And then really, the onus, though, in terms of if, you have the potential for fracturing to continue and you do, the risk is high, It's on the Fed. And all you got to do is, in today's actual Weldon Live, it's our daily research, I mean, we got a couple of really cool charts, one of which is one we use all the time. It's the U.S. two-year against the Japanese two-year against the European two-year. Where is the easing going to come from? It's going to come from the U.S. They're going to work bond yields down and try and, you know, bring the dollar down without it, you know, sliding too quickly. And we think the chances are good that this is exactly what's going to happen. We started talking, you know, we saw it happening last week, and it has intensified in a big way this week. And we think the read initially dollar higher off Brexit was misplaced because it means less Fed hawkishness, number one, drives the dollar to where it is now and potentially breaks the dollar at this 91.90 level if the Fed even has to begin to puppeteer the other way and start to support this decline in bond yields, and we think they will.
Now, let me move to precious metals, because we were talking before we got on here, and you think this move has just started, and I generally agree, and I wanted to get your answer specifically on why you believe that.
Well, I'll tell you what, I want to ask you, what was the analogy I made? Because it was really good, and I already forgot it. You know, it's because of what we just said. I mean, it's early stage in the sense that you have only just now removed Fed tightening from the picture. Okay, the next step is to, you know, get the dollar lower to make sure you cushion global growth at a time when you're going to see intensified turbulence geopolitically. You have the U.S., you know, the big summer of conventions coming up in the U.S. is going to bring a lot more rhetoric around a, you know, separatist type of thing. You know, Spanish elections were a little more favorable than people thought they might be, but there's still not like a real solid government there. You have all these countries. We did a piece yesterday on France. I mean, they're at, you know, almost 99% debt to GDP. It's gone up every year. When do you start talking about that in terms of you know, the downside in bond yields here against what's going to be a rollout of year-over-year deflation in energy prices? Look at some food prices, coffee, sugar up, even stuff like milk and butter up. So, you know, there's a lot going on here that's going to work in favor of the precious metals. And to the degree that you potentially start moving into, you know, could the Fed be in a box here where they might have to discuss, you know, easing or working bond yields lower at a time when prices are starting to rise? What's going to happen then? It's going to be really interesting to see. And I think I never want to use this phrase ever with a market, ever, because the second you do, you're doomed to failure. But, you know, to some degree, precious metals, and we're not saying from here because they've gotten a little ahead of themselves here, but, you know, it's a major technical breakout in a long-term picture, and it almost seems like a win-win backdrop. Unless the Fed or some, you know, is to make a mistake here and, you know, tighten anyway.
Just a quick follow-up on that. I mean, Greg, can they even tighten to a degree that would really alter the move in precious metals? I mean, sure, I could see them tightening and precious metals correcting, but I'm just skeptical that they could tighten. That mean, could they actually tighten and create more than just like a short-term or interim reaction?
Possibly. I mean, the odds are smaller that it's, you know, totally detrimental, but that those odds are not, you know, tiny either. So if the Fed were to make a mistake here and stock markets got loose, or, you know, the Fed tightens and all of a sudden you have some other kind of, you know, situation around a country wanting to leave the EU, you know, that could be really detrimental to equity prices, and you could bring a bigger picture deflation down where gold, you know, performs on a relative basis in a scenario where everything goes down. So, you know, that's always the risk in my mind to the precious metals. And, you know, you've had this experience over the last couple of years where, you know, obviously gold and silver were down, but for much different reasons, just because the Fed had the safety net under the equity market. So what did it pay to own gold? Nothing versus equities. All of that's changed. All of that's changed. The Fed doesn't have the safety net there anymore. There's no returns to be had in stocks. You know, and bond yields are negative with central banks saying we're going to take them further into negative territory. And all of a sudden, you know, gold on a real basis is a high yielding asset. So, you know, I think that while there is always risk to gold, I think the bigger picture, when you take go back to 99, a 12-year bull market, a 4-year correction, it's 50% ABC. The math around the gold market, silver too, to a lesser extent, because the correction was a little deeper than you would want to see mathematically, but that's liquidity dynamics. And gold-silver ratio breaking down in a big way here, by the way, Jordan, as I'm sure you know.
you know, doesn't suggest that the risk here to gold and silver is significant. It just doesn't. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Certainly position sizes, people being long the market, you know, is your biggest near-term risk. That's always a consideration, you know, day in, day out. But in the bigger picture, it's a buy-the-dip mentality.
And what about gold strength against foreign currencies? I know you watched that. What are you seeing there?
Well, I mean, there has been a little bit of shake there. You do see some, you know, pivots in certain currencies, like the Brazilian real, for example, Russian ruble even. But, you know, you've had huge moves in those, in gold in those currencies to where, you know, some kind of little correction on a correction in the dollar, you know, could be something that happens concurrent, you know, to a rise in the dollar price, as opposed to, you know, it suggests that the dollar price of gold is at risk here of following. I don't see it that way. Not at all. So, of course, you know, I mean, from a gold bug perspective, you'd rather see it rallying in all currencies, but our focus is on the dollar, and our pricing in gold is dollar-based, and from that perspective, it looks fine to me.
And you touched on the gold-silver ratio. I mean, silver showing a lot of strength breaking out this week. Give us some thoughts on the silver breakout this week and what that means for precious metals.
Well, I mean, the gold-silver ratio breakdown is huge because it hasn't broken down. It's actually been closer to its highs, you know, historically. So silver, you know, has been a significant underperformer on this downside move over the last 4 years, you know, exceeded its Fibonacci numbers by far, whereas gold, you know, barely stayed below for even a matter of days, the 50% retracement going back to 1999. So from that perspective, I think it's only beginning, and I think when you talk about a market that's obviously less liquid and swings more too, so you're going to get the exacerbated move to the upside now that you just had to the downside. I'm not thrilled with the participation right now. It's pretty high, but you can't let that stop you all the time from, you know, from participating. You know, you want to be long silver right here for sure, because I think it's going to $26. And when, you know, our Outlook 2016 piece that we wrote on January 4th for the year ahead, gold and silver, time to rise and shine. We picked the silver mining shares as our top picks for this year. And you look at something like First Majestic's up almost 300%. It was our top pick off the SIL, which was kind of what the piece was based on. And that's up 150% this year, making new highs pretty much as we speak. So, you know, we nailed it. You don't want to chase this market. You want to find a pullback to buy. I mean, really, silver only just kind of broke out today. Above $18. So, you know, it's moved a lot already. If you get a 30, 40, 50 cent pullback from here, I think it's all in.
Yeah, so you said $26 for silver is your target. Do you have a gold target that goes along with that?
Generally speaking, yeah. I mean, you know, 1600. But I think, you know, the bigger picture technical overlay right here, if you take a long-term perspective, you know, suggests that this was a correction in an ongoing bull market, which should see new highs. So, you know, how that plays out is going to, you know, I mean, it's going to take time. This is, you know, longer-term outlook. But the suggestion is, and one of the things I said, I might have said this on your show even when we last spoke. When I wrote my book, Gold Trading Bootcamp, it was 2006. It was published in 2007. We were extremely bullish on gold for a lot of the same reasons, you know, that we see now, that central banks are boxed in. They're going to have to, you know, err on the side of easing because the downside risk on the other side of the coin is just too, you know, too painful. It's that simple. It's pain avoidance. Bottom line, central banking, you know, 101, their job is avoid pain. So from that perspective, we said earlier this year, and again, I believe on your show, that we were as bullish on gold here when it was, you know, 1200, 1250, as we were in 2006 when it was basically 350 to 400.
Right, yeah, I recall that. No, you were very bullish on gold in early January, before at least January 21st, I believe, which was the day the gold miners bottomed. Greg, let's switch gears and talk about the stock market. I mean, how has this thing continued to hold up despite the negative data? Is it Fed policy? Is it some kind of capital flows? Is it? I mean, it kind of looks a little bit like 99 to 2001, where it was kind of a stealth bear market. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are your thoughts?
Well, I'll tell you what the stock market in the U.S. at least looks like to me is exactly like the Fed's balance sheet. I mean, it's really that simple. Fed's balance sheet's gone sideways. Stock market's gone sideways. You have no return in equities without the Fed boosting their balance sheet. So why haven't stocks gone down? Well, because they haven't sold off any securities. They haven't really shrunk their balance sheet. There's been a week or two here and there when it's been down. There's been a, you know, your 52-week rate of change occasionally, you know, dips into negative territory. But that doesn't stay that way because they're reinvesting the proceeds. So it's basically flat, which is exactly what the stock market is doing. So, you know, it's become an onus on the ECB and the BOJ. I mean, look at what the ECB has done. I mean, and then look at the Spanish and Italian stock markets. They barely had a 38% correction of the entire crisis decline. These are not markets that are close to new highs by any stretch of the imagination. That includes the Euro Stoxx 50. You know, I mean, outside of Germany and Japan, you don't see it. You don't see it. You see the markets that are doing the best are markets like Argentina, where they're devaluing the currency like crazy. I mean, so again, that's the backdrop. And this is also potentially a reason why the Fed could come back into play, like we're saying. I mean, it's a two-step process. We've gone through almost all of step one, removing tightening from the equation. You know, when do we move to the next step where they, you know, at least start to, you know, puppeteer the strings in people's minds the other way? And I think there is some of that. Now, even if you listen to what they say about why they feel they should tighten, it's almost we need to tighten because we know we're going to have to ease again, and we need some symmetry to policy because we have none. And that's a real common theme in their speeches, in the minutes. I mean, so, you know, and it wasn't how long ago was it that Yellen dangled QE4 in front of Congress? I mean, so, you know, keeping all that in mind, we think the Fed could come back into play further down the road because without it, the stock market goes nowhere because it's contingent upon the Fed. It's that simple. I mean, so, you know, do you see profits zooming? No. Do you have, you know, margins? No. Do you able to raise prices? No. Is it still competitive out there? Yes. So from that perspective, you look at how many businesses are really still kind of struggling from the perspective of where is the next huge slug of dollar growth from the consumer going to come? If not for the decline in gasoline prices in the last 12 to 16, 18 months, I think the stock market would already be lower and the Fed would be in a different place already. So, you know, that decline, you know, made up for Fed easing that wasn't taking place. That decline no longer works, you know, mathematically. It's not there anymore. So, you know, from that perspective, when we look at the numbers in the retail sales like a hawk, dollar for dollar. You know, every $3 less people had to spend at the gas stations, $2 were spent at eating and drinking establishments. That's why it was one of the most robust growth in jobs was in eating and drinking establishments. Unfortunately, that's a low-paying job for the most part. So, you know, therein is one big reason you didn't see wage growth. It's really that simple when you break the numbers down. So you don't have that anymore. Where is it going to come from? Where is Nike going to make, you know, their next $1 billion in growth? In growth. It's not about staying here. It's about growth. And this is something I think is lost on a lot of people. It's not, you know, it's not just about, I mean, look at China. They go from 6% growth to 5.5% growth, and everyone would freak out, despite the fact that nominally their GDP is higher than ever every single quarter. That's not enough. It's about the growth rate, and it's increasingly hard to generate that growth rate, certainly from a policy standpoint. And I don't think that would get much debate on that point, you know. Bottom line. So there you go. Long rambling question is stocks are sideways until the Fed shifts.
Well, Greg, it seems like with the Fed being so impotent here and, you know, with elections around the corner, it just seems like increased government spending is going to come into play at some point as, you know, maybe the catalyst for the next expansion, because Fed policy sure can't do anything right now. I mean, what is your view on that? And I know that's probably, you know, further off than what we're talking about here, but do you have any thoughts on that?
It's absolutely possible. There's already talk about it in many places, including in the U.S. and in private circles. I mean, I know, you know, some of the think tank guys that actually speak to people in the government, I'm not one of them and I don't care to be, a couple of them are my clients. So, you know, if I want to, you know, pick someone's brain, I have some good people I can call on this. And the bottom line is there is actually an undertone, let's call it an undertow, a little riptide of thought that, you know what? It's just bonds. We can sell as many, the market's so hungry for bonds, we can sell as many bonds as we want. We can still get the central banks to buy the bulk of them if there's ever an issue. And that, you know, really doesn't matter how much money we spend or what our budget deficits are or how much debt we have, because we'll just eliminate it. And we talked about this in the book I wrote in 2006 as well. We called it the monetary Armageddon scenario, where, you know, much like the nukes, and you need two guys with the keys, and they turn the keys simultaneously in the old, you know, Hollywood movies, and then someone lifts up the little protector over the switch, and you hit the switch. And they can do that in the bond market and vaporize every piece of paper, every IOU that's ever been printed. This is one of the reasons I like a long-term perspective that's bullish on gold. Because this is a very real possibility. There's discussions at the academic level of, you know what, you know, we need to expand budget deficits because it really doesn't matter. We can just vaporize the paper at the end of the day, and we need to spend the money. So against that, the paper might be vaporized, but there's some quid pro quo. And in my mind, you know, that's gold on the other side of that trade, you know, just in terms of central bank credibility. I mean, how about if central banks don't care about their credibility because they really can't? Well, you know, they're in that position. It is a little bit longer term stuff. It's not something that's going to happen tomorrow. But that is something that is in the mindset of a lot of people in the hierarchy of government.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems to me if I mean, I know you've talked more about the market than the economy, but if the economy looks like it's going into recession at the end of the year, or early next year, it just seems, I mean, if you're a policymaker, what else are you going to do? I mean, where is the growth going to come from, as you say?
Yeah, I know. It's key, and I find it interesting that, you know, somebody on television the other day said, because I've been saying it for so long, and, you know, I don't really put it out there too much. Just, I mean, it's 2% is kind of your normal growth now, which suggests, you know, relatively speaking, 0% is normal. And they talk about normalization. You're normal right where you are now for where you are now. So from that perspective, yes, yeah, something's got to give. And can it be monetary policy? Has its limitations. And if you're going to buy all these bonds, you know, why not spend more money and print more bonds? And there'd be certainly demand for bonds out there, you know, because people are hungry for yield. So, you know, in this environment, not saying it's the right thing to do. There's no academic answers. Solutions passed this by 20 years ago, if not much, much, you know, longer ago. 1990, 91 was the, you know, last time you really had a chance to fix things, and you didn't. So that's gone. Doing the academically correct thing here is not even on the table because it doesn't exist. So keeping in mind that that's why I say these things, it's not like I'm in favor of this. I mean, all these moves are really the wrong moves, but it's the, you know, not doing them is too painful. And again, this is what central banks and governments, I mean, they're in the business of, you know, making sure we avoid pain. So, yeah, they'll spend, they'll ease, they'll buy debt, they'll do whatever they have to do to keep us from that deflationary abyss, you know, that comes about with a, you know, with a real debt deflation and too much debt out there and you can't pay it back. And really, you know, where are yields going to go from here? I mean, wow. I mean, think about it. You think about the U.S., I mean, a five-year note above 190, and you're talking, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars added to the deficit, which is already growing, which has already bottomed, you know, which would still be a record deficit before 2009. And no one talks about it. Nobody. We've gone from $9 trillion, $8.5 trillion, to $19 trillion in debt in the U.S. Who talks about it? Nobody. I mean, those things still lay out there. So from that perspective, the black hole is even more powerful than it ever was. They just had, you know, this is something one of my big themes used to be paper burning. I almost called my book paper burning. Because what you have is a giant bonfire. And you have to keep throwing wood on the bonfire, it's going to die down. Okay, so that's easy when the bonfire has 10 pieces of wood on it. When it has trillions of pieces of wood on it, you got to keep adding trillions of pieces of wood to it to keep it burning. And this is exactly what I'm talking about. Where is the growth in that fire going to come from? You're dealing with kindling relative to the size of this fire. And that's why you have no growth. That's why you have no reflation. And that's why you have central banks that are still cutting wood. Oh, I like that. That's a good one.
Greg, you've covered so much here today. Before I let you go, is there anything you want to comment on that we didn't touch on?
Gosh, I mean, 9 million things. And, you know, we haven't really talked much about Asia, China, Japan, South America. I mean, there are markets that I like here in this shorter term scenario where they potentially work the dollar down. Look what the Brazilian real's done, the Chilean peso's done, copper's rallying. I mean, so there are places to invest. I mean, I don't like the industrialized nations, countries with all this debt that are, you know, trying to manipulate their bonds and so on and so forth. But you have more kind of hard asset places where if, you know, yields aren't rising, they stand to benefit. And there are a number of them. We did a big piece on Brazil this week. We did a big piece on Mexico. I mean, Chilean peso, to me, is a really interesting currency. Copper, again, breaking out. The LME metals look very good here, frankly. And that's interesting because you've turned some of the supply side dynamics. Now, not hugely, not, 10 years out. But, let's not forget, you have no investment in this area either. So, from a supply side thing, you've had tons of supply. You've had readily available supply. Maybe that doesn't apply anymore. And from that perspective, we're seeing rumblings in many, many commodity markets. And there are certainly many emerging market countries involved in those commodity markets that have, had bigger corrections, have underperformed, haven't performed at all. And now their currencies are starting to look a little perky. And this is, again, kind of links back to my whole dollar theme. So from that perspective, there are other places on a near to medium-term basis that are in play.
All right, Greg. Well, thanks so much for that. And before I let you go, can you tell our listeners what they can find at Weldon Financial and how they can subscribe or follow your work?
Yeah, it's weldononline.com, W-E-L-D-O-N, online, one word, .com. And we actually have just completely restructured our research product. We've simplified it. We've honed it. We've combined it. I personally, and I don't say this, I hate being a sales guy. I really do. It's not what I love to do. Just love to be in my cave buried in the data so I can produce really good research and give people an angle they might not have thought of otherwise. But this product that we're offering now for the price we're offering it is the best deal we've ever had in terms of the value, the content, the depth, the breadth of coverage. It's Weldon Live. It comes in three parts. And it's the same, it's all three are included in one subscription price. It's a daily 12 to 15 minute video. In that video, I'm with a pointer going through charts like a conference presentation every day. And those charts are drawn from the chart pack, which you also get, which is much more comprehensive than what you see in the video, usually somewhere from 60 to 70 pages a day covering global macro, number one, fixed income, number two, foreign exchange, stock indexes globally, metals, that includes industrial and precious, energy, and ags. We have seven sections in our chart pack every day, roughly 70 pages each day. And the third thing that comes with the subscription is our trade lab, which is specific trading recommendations on a discretionary basis, and then some quantitative work as it applies to sector portfolio weightings as well. So all of that can be had for a free trial at WeldonOnline.com, and anyone that has any difficulty in any way, shape, or form with the website can email me directly at GregWeldon@WeldonOnline.com.
Thanks for that, Greg. Again, that's WeldonOnline.com. Greg, thanks so much for taking the time today to come on the show. I and my listeners really appreciate it. Great stuff, as always, and I look forward to having you back again in the months ahead.
Yeah, thank you. You do a great job, Jordan, so I'm always happy to contribute.